TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Technology and Globalization. From Steamboats to the WTO, Kirkpatrick Sale and Helena Norberg Hodge. The technologies of globalism, genetic engineering, and computer technologies are bound to have earth-shattering effects, says Kirkpatrick Sale. We do not control them, we have shaped them, and now they shape us. Kirkpatrick Sale is the author of Rebels Against the Future, The Conquest of Paradise, and The Green Revolution. He writes for periodicals in the U.S. and Britain and is on the board of the E.F. Schumacher Society. Kirkpatrick Sale.
In 1945, after the House of Commons had been destroyed by German bombing, there was some debate in England about how to rebuild it. Winston Churchill, then the Prime Minister, decreed that it should be rebuilt exactly as it had been before, a long rectangle shape with benches on both sides. We shape our buildings, he said in a now famous aphorism, and thereafter they shape us. Now, what he meant by that was that it was the very oblong nature of that building that over four centuries had created the British system of two distinct parties, oppositional political parties, both directed by a row of leaders who engaged in confrontational and challenging face-to-face debates. Whereas other forms of legislatures in the world, for example, in France and the United States, where there were theater-shaped, semicircular rooms, that led to a completely different system. A lack of direct and open debate, many parties, blurred party lines, individual posturing and spectatorship, as in a theater, and no collective cabinet-style government. We shape our buildings, but there are always consequences of which we are most often unaware, as they are shaping us. And so it is with all technologies, always. They are not neutral. Technologies that succeed in our civilization have always been those that enhance the political and economic structures in ascendancy at that time. And they are the tools, the agents, the shapees of those powers. Yes, acting as they're supposed to act. But, they are also the shapers of that society. And they come with their own biases and implications that are built into them, more complex and directional than the regimes there know or ever will know, more complex than they can control. And one way or another, these technologies transform the very nature of the culture that they are in, with psychological and social implications that are usually far more profound than the economic and political implications. Let me give you an example, and I want to make it as neutral and unemotive as possible so that you can draw your own parallels. It is the technology of the steamboat, the great symbol of the showy, splashy, fast nation in the 19th century. What were the consequences of the steamboat? How did it shape us? First of all, it brought the Industrial Revolution to America. It called forth an industrial substructure of mechanics and ironsmiths and boatwrights, and the engineers and the foundries and the manufactories in order to create it all along the rivers and the coasts of America within 20 years. Within a generation after 1807, industrialism was already an American way of life. And as Henry Adams put it, 1807 was the real line between the colonial stage and the independent stage of America as a nation. Second, the steamboat expanded the violent potential of a violent society and became its instrument of military conquest. As Fulton himself, at the end of his life, realized, when he created a ship of war, a steamboat ship of war, it was large and maneuverable and fast and therefore inevitably had to be used by armies. And it was used in the interior against Indians and Mexicans and used on the oceans as the primary instrument of our military conquest for the next century. Third, the steamboat enabled a huge immigration of white people to invade the interior of the country. And now, as Mark Twain later said, there was some reason for all those rivers. The long rivers of this continent had been useless until you could go up them again. And so with that, the steamboat enabled all these people to pour into the interior of the country and have a success there. 3.5 million people in the 20 years after the steamboat, more than had come to the original 13 colonies in 200 years. And thereafter, of course, all of these people in the interior, the destruction of the Indian societies that were there in their way, the extinction of species, the clear-cutting of the interior, and the ideology of the legitimacy of all of this, called manifest destiny, but in fact nothing more than imperialism. Next, the steamboat, being ideally suited for transporting heavy and bulky goods in large quantities over long hauls, was essential for the solidification and the growth of the plantation economy of King Cotton from Virginia to Texas, and hence the spread and the perpetuation of a brutal slavery which probably otherwise would have dried up and withered and gone. And hence, of course, of a civil war. And then, too, the steamboat ratified in the minds of this growing nation the principle that it was right and possible and natural to develop technologies that were capable of transcending the limits of nature, overcoming tides and currents and winds and waves. The steamboat showed that we could conquer nature, and we could make it entirely utilitarian and exploitable. We could, with our own technologies, conquer nature. And finally, by his extraordinary success, the steamboat served to sanction the very idea of technology as the legitimate and necessary means by which the nation was to grow and progress. Technology would always be the measure of a society. We went around the world looking at other societies, judging them as to whether they were technological or not. And if they were not, they were developing toward that technology. So, it's simple. Technologies have consequences, broad, deep consequences, far beyond any reckoning when first they appear. I don't need to connect the dots for you. You can see that the technologies of globalism, mostly the electronic technologies, but the biogenetic ones, are bound to have earth-shaping, and I would practically guarantee earth-shattering effects. even if we have no way to predict what they will all be. But they have been developed in the last 30 years. We do not control them. We have shaped them, and now they shape us. We can at least suggest, though, what direction they are going to take us. It's not complicated. What's going to happen to us as a culture, as a nation, as a world? The direction they are taking us to is not safe, sensible, happy, livable, survivable. How do I know this? I just read the papers. It's in the papers. It's simple. Let me give you two examples from just the last couple of weeks. The Erector Set Company is going out of business because kids no longer have enough imagination to play with toys that don't blip and shoot and slice and like the electronic toys. Professor Diane Levin at some education training college in Boston says that she works with teachers whose students today don't even know how to play with Play-Doh. They poke at the Play-Doh and say, "What does it do?" And over in Davos, Switzerland, at that fancy World Economic Forum where the richest and most powerful globalists gather to set their global agendas for the next round of world rape, there was, according to Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, a backlash against the proliferation of technology in our lives. These are the prime technologists in the world. But there was one big-time CEO who said, after a workshop on 24/7 cutthroat capitalism, "While we're all competing or dying, when will there be time for sex or music or books? Stop the world, I want to get off." This is the generator of this technology, talking this way. And one Howard Stringer, chairman of Sony America, after someone laid out the world of the Evernet-run global techno future, he said, "Doesn't anyone here think this sounds like a vision of hell?" Head of Sony America. So they're beginning to get it. They're beginning to see it. You see it. We see it. There it is. It is hell. If these guys know it, perhaps we can get everyone to know it. Perhaps we can wake everyone to know that. All you have to lose are your boxes. The boxes on your desks, in your office, on your laps, for they are all, as we now know, Pandora's boxes. Thank you.
That was Kirkpatrick Sale. He's a nonfiction writer and environmental activist. In his books such as Rebels Against the Future, The Luddites and Their War on the Industrial Revolution, and The Conquest of Paradise, Christopher Columbus and the Columbian Legacy, he connects in an intriguing and often surprising way history and modern thought. The next speaker is Helena Norberg Hodge. Her life changed when she first visited, almost 30 years ago, the small country of Ladakh, deep in the Himalayan mountains, on the western edge of the Tibetan Plateau. Ladakh, then untouched by Western influence, was at peace, in balance, and affluent in spite of the harsh climate. Helena Norberg Hodge witnessed firsthand the collapse of much of that paradise under the onslaught of Western influence and economic globalization. She began her talk on technology and globalization that you are about to hear with a list of well-known crisis points that now affect us all: global warming, antibiotic resistance, and the destruction of the very basis of life, local food and farming. However, she says, we finally know what the common underlying causes for this crisis are. Helena Norberg Hodge.
The genie is out of the bottle, And the genie is that globalization as a systemic economic arrangement linked to science and technology, that globalization lies behind most of these crises. As people wake up to this understanding that there is a systemic root cause that is responsible for so many disastrous impacts, people feel empowered again, and they are out on the streets, as you have seen. The anti-globalization movement wants control of corporations, want to see these speculative activities taxed. Their very reasonable demands were reported on the news. And I tell you, there is reason for optimism, because the awareness of this root underlying cause is growing very, very rapidly. And that is the genie that's got out of the bottle that was never on the table before. Historically, as we have fought for human rights, for environmental protection, we did not look at trade and investment treaties, at global economic arrangements, as an underlying engine of destruction. And so we've seen huge progress. So please take heart and please join this movement. Now, before I go into talking more about what we can do, I want you to be very aware of the fact that we are living in an age of manufactured mind. We have a mindscape which is so monocultural, so controlled, that it's almost impossible to get accurate information. And we have to be really, really aware of that constantly and look for reliable sources of information, which is one of the reasons why in my institute, one of the most important parts of our activities is to organize reality tours between North and South. Because on both sides of that divide, of the less developed so-called world and the most developed world so-called, there is a huge information gap, a huge information divide that keeps both populations manipulated and disempowered. In our institute, we try to encourage both resistance and renewal. Well, what can we do to resist? We need, I believe, the most strategic thing in terms of resistance is to lobby for a moratorium, for a freeze on further trade deregulation of any kind. No new extension to NAFTA, no new extension to the EU, and certainly no GATS. So that resistance, however, I think should be simply moratorium. I think that's the most strategic thing. That is asking for a time. An appropriate time period would be something like 5 to 10 years to examine the impact of the deregulation that's happened already. It is, in effect, exactly what we need also in science and technology. The precautionary principle will allow us the time with each new product to ensure that it is tested before it is set loose on society. And so a precautionary principle, moratorium, we need to educate ourselves also to realize how we need to shift all those hidden subsidies. If food from the other side of the world costs less than local food in your community, and this is now the case around the world, food from the other side of the world costs less than food from a mile away. That is not a level playing field. You have vast hidden subsidies for the transportation infrastructure, for the petroleum industry, for the research and the development. And this is why the tax monies and examining where they go into science, into technology, into the development of the infrastructure, how they are linked to, in a systemic way, encouraging export-import. This is what we have to examine and lobby against. Regulations are operating in a very similar way. We have deregulation at the global level, helping that small group of mega merged corporations and banks. But at the local and regional level, regulations are strangling and killing small farmers in particular, but also small restaurants and a whole fabric of businesses that are efficient healthier, more accountable. So re-examining regulations at the global and the local level is another key element in understanding globalization. And all the time what will emerge is the link between research, science, technology, and economics. I believe that the new politics needs to be a politics of global to local. I think biotechnology and genetics are part of that systemic change. I think with a big picture analysis, it becomes very easy to argue with people that jobs as well as the environment are at stake. Jobs and the environment. In Seattle, we had for the first time, again, historical alliances between labor and environmentalists. This is a unique opportunity that globalization as a systemic process of global growth that offers us this big picture analysis that in turn creates the alliances. If you care about the psychology of your children, the loss of biodiversity, the loss of culture, and the loss of your job, if you are alarmed by the speed in our society, the way that all of us are being made to run faster and faster and faster, work longer hours in our jobs, that is one of the main reasons to look at globalization. So if you do the broad systemic analysis, we have the opportunity to mobilize almost everyone. There, in every single instance, you will find that what you care about, and I hope you care about the disastrous impact of the time shortage in your lives, the fact that most of us have almost no time for ourselves, for our children, for what we care about, that is one of the main reasons why you need now to take the time. We need to take the time, as little time as we have, one of the most empowering and I think you will find in the end one of the most intelligent and beneficial things you ever did is to study globalization and to realize that it helps to empower you, that you then understand that the media, the dominant agenda, hasn't been giving you the right picture and has been helping to immobilize you, disempower you. It's partly through presenting a fragmented analysis, partly by pointing the finger at you as being the failure, you as being the problem, individualizing and fragmenting all the issues. So looking at the big picture, how these things connect, is about activism. It's about how to mobilize people. It's really about economic literacy. It's understanding the economics behind the politics. The new politics about global to local is fundamentally about scale. It's about bringing back visibility and accountability through decentralizing economic activity. That single step towards decentralization is a solution multiplier that will solve a whole range of problems at once. This is something that the world recognized 25 years ago. After Rachel Carson's book came out, there was an outcry across the Western world. People wanted more holistic knowledge, more holistic interdisciplinary science. People demanded at the same time that we decentralize development, that we build up a renewable energy infrastructure in the Western world. Even in America, there was a sizable budget for solar energy, and there was a demand across the board for decentralized renewable energy technologies in the industrialized world. So universities across Europe and America set up interdisciplinary departments. There were projects, there were government-funded initiatives to do this. What happened? The giant corporations organized, not because they're evil people, but because they were people inhabiting those corporations who wanted to marry economic growth with sustainability. They came up with a formula that they presented at the Rio meeting in 92. This was supposed to be one of the most wonderful global meeting of non-governmental organizations across the world to solve global environmental problems. The giant corporations had been involved from the very beginning, not only setting up the agenda for that meeting, but dominating the media, funding environmental organizations, and on the agenda by 1992, not a word about decentralized renewable energy, not a word about changing science to the interdisciplinary and holistic science that we needed and that Rachel Carson had made so clear we needed. And finally, I want to say that when you start studying what localization is about, and when you start practicing localization, you're talking about community building. You're talking about reconnecting to the place where you live, as we've heard earlier. And you're talking about an almost instantaneous cultural shift towards a richer and more joyous life. Thank you.
That was Helena Norberg-Hodge, founder and director of ISEC, the International Society for Ecology and Culture. ISEC runs resistance and renewal programs on four continents aimed at strengthening cultural self-respect and community. They support local and regional economies while encouraging resistance to the global consumer culture. She's the author of the international classic Ancient Futures, Learning from Ladakh, and the producer of the documentary film with the same title, Learning from Ladakh. Helena Norberg-Hodge and Kirkpatrick Sale were recorded at the Teach-In on Technology and Globalization by the International Forum on Globalization. I hope you have a pen handy for more information. You can get a copy of today's program with Helena Norberg-Hodge and Kirkpatrick Sale that includes next week's talk by Walden Bellow on hydro and nuclear electricity for $12. TUC Radio is listener-supported. Your tape order helps us continue our work. Our mailing address is TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. Our website is www.tucradio.org. You can order with your credit card by phone or on the web. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to do this. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Gladden. Thank you for listening.